From WHQR Public Media, this is The Newsroom. I'm Rachel Keith.
And I'm Aaliyah McConnell.
The country is embarking on a celebration of its 250th anniversary, and right here in the Cape Fear region is a piece of history that's emblematic of this nation's complicated and nuanced story, the Black Rock House. Located near Regalwood in what is now Columbus County, the Black Rock Plantation House is a simple but elegant two-story Greek Revival home, situated on a sprawling lawn on a property that stretches roughly a mile to the Cape Fear River. Built almost two centuries ago in 1845, Black Rock is also known as the Allen Love House, named for two of the families that built and later occupied it. It's a storied place, and it's intersected the history and lives of many families.
Ernestine Keaton, whose ancestors were enslaved here and later came to thrive as free people and community leaders after the Civil War, Jim Moore, whose family owned plantations here, and Everett Lewis, the latest owner of the house, who's been digging into its complicated history. Ernestine Keaton wants her ancestors who lived and worked there to be commemorated. And part of the story she wanted to be told is the story of those who owned her ancestors. She also wants people to know that her family transcended that hardship through resilience. They now serve in local government. Her cousins and her brother help run the town of Sandyfield near Black Rock Plantation.
On this show, we'll take you through stories that touch on the Revolutionary War, the Civil War, post-Reconstruction, and into the 20th and 21st centuries. These stories are woven through one house at Black Rock.
The Keaton family are longtime residents of Sandyfield, near the Black Rock House. It's a town of over 400 people, but not by much, that neighbors East Arcadia. We first told their story on WHQR's Coastline a few years ago and introduced Ernestine Keaton, who is the resident historian of the Keaton tribe. Sandyfield is about 3 square miles with around 450 people. Historically African American, the population is still 63% Black, including many families that, like the Keatons, have lived here for generations. Driving through the town, much of it is open land with time-worn general stores and miscellaneous commercial buildings at every other stoplight. A mid-20th century paper mill is the town's nucleus. According to Ernestine, much of Sandyfield's rural old town charm is still intact. For her, it harkens back to the days when music from the nearby Piccolo joint would echo through the town, making Ernestine and other youth her age rush to finish their chores, whether they were scrubbing floors or working in the tobacco fields, so they can join in on the fun. Despite growing up in rural southeastern North Carolina during Jim Crow, Ernestine says she didn't think too much about her race, living in a community that was, and still is, predominantly Black. She says, after emancipation, her ancestors stayed and worked on Black Rock Plantation. And throughout the Reconstruction period to the present, the Keaton family legacy has been woven into the fabric of this town, as members of their family would work in the paper mill, in the fertilizer industry, and come to own some land for themselves. Based on her research, in the oral history handed down through the generations, her ancestors were once owned by wealthy planter and lawyer D.D. Allen from 1843 to 1865, the end of the American Civil War. Once they were freed, they took on the last name of one of the plantation's earlier owners, John Grange. Ernestine recently learned more about this history from her friend Ulysse Willis, the recently retired mayor of the historically Black town of Navassa, and a fellow history buff. Here's Ulysse.
One of the things that I had was an 1870 agricultural census, right? Mm-hmm. And this agricultural census from 1870 listed all former slaves that was on these different plantations, right? I again made a copy of that thing and gave it to Ernestine. So she took that and looked at that Black Rock plantation and spotted all of her ancestors.
And ever since Keaton found this piece of her family's legacy, she's been on a journey to uncover more. That's what led her to the front steps of Black Rock Plantation, where she stood for the first time some years ago next to her sister Cecile Bryant, observing the otherworldliness of Black Rock, a place that transcends time.
This doesn't belong here. This is of another time. Mm-hmm. And I was like drawn to this house. And the picture of me, Seal took the picture of me looking up, you know, at it. And it's like this. And she said, Ernie, you look like you trying to figure out why are you coming here?
To answer that question, we'll have to go to the beginning. I mean, the very beginning. Before the American Revolution and some of the first white families to settle in the area.
One important thread is the powerful Moore family, who owned much of the land around Black Rock. Here's Jim Moore, a modern-day descendant who visited the plantation house with us and Ernestine Keaton earlier this year.
Let's see, this property has been placed on the National Register of Historic Places by the United States Department of the Interior.
The house sits on the Bladen and Columbus County line, and Jim Moore is the owner of James E. Moore Insurance Company, and full disclosure, they're a WHQR underwriter, but that's not why he's included in this story. Over the past several years, his daughter has taken over the business, giving him time to explore his ancestry.
I grew up in Wilmington, lived all my life there, so for about 9 or 10 years, Chapel Hill and Air Force, and really didn't know anything about my ancestors until maybe 5 years ago, and somehow picked up ancestry, started playing, and said, well, this is interesting.
Jim Moore's research took him back to before the Revolutionary War.
I am the great-grandson of Nathaniel Moore. He's my sixth great-grandfather.
And Jim says that because the Moores were such a powerful family, they intermarried. And when we sat down with Jim, Ernestine, and Cecile Bryant, you can hear them in the background reacting to this.
And talking about the wealthy people inbreeding. Nathaniel is my great-grandfather, as is Maurice. Yeah. So how does that happen? Their great-grandchildren married each other.
Nathaniel was a part of this family who bought up tons of land around the Cape Fear region when the British were settling America and started many plantations in the area. James Moore was the father of Nathaniel, as well as Maurice and the infamous King Roger Moore. One of the reasons they called him King was the way he ran his plantation at Orton. According to NCpedia, it was because of his, quote, grand manner and his reputation as a generous host. However, the same website listed that Moore enslaved more than 250 people and owned nearly 60,000 acres of land. The Moores were planters, originally from Charleston, South Carolina, and some of their ancestors, as Jim Moore says, came from Barbados. They, too, were planters there. Jim says he's been trying to locate the exact coordinates of the land grants given to his ancestors by Britain.
There are only three or four points of reference to find these plantations, these grants. And one is Indian Creek, which Nathaniel Moore's main property, which is Black Rock later, started right at the mouth of Indian Creek into the river.
And we walk down to a place where Jim thinks his ancestors owned some of this land.
Land grants, if you read the descriptions of the property, it'll say beginning at a gum tree here at the mouth of Indian Creek, go 82 poles in this direction up the river. And a pole, I think, is 16 feet, if I remember correctly.
Everett Lewis is the current owner of the Black Rock House and lives mainly in California, teaching film production at the University of Southern California. He bought the house 15 years ago. His family is from Brunswick County, and they also go back to around the country's founding. We caught up with Lewis out in the urban jungle of Los Angeles. You'll sometimes hear construction, cars honking, and birds chirping when he's talking.
About, I guess now 15 years ago, I realized my family was aging out and that if I wanted to participate in the lives of these people, I would have to make an effort to do that. So I decided to start spending summers and holidays here because when I moved to LA, I basically moved to LA and would spend a week or whatever. And then I noticed that people were dying. And so I decided to come back as much as I could because I did like my extended family quite a bit.
Lewis wanted to return to southeastern North Carolina to connect with his family. He was originally interested in an older home in Fayetteville, but the sellers were asking too much for the state it was in, he thought. He then drove by Black Rock and saw that it was for sale.
All I could see was just a part of the roof and the cornice. And the cornice of the exterior is what caught my eye because the detailing was, most of the houses on that road are from the early 20th century. And this house was not. You could tell from the details it was a much older house.
Lewis then realized what he found was a totally preserved house from the 19th century.
You know, when I got the house, I didn't know what it was going to turn into. None of this information was, there was no information. The people who owned it didn't know anything about it.
Lewis has done significant research on the house, its evolving history, including the Moore family.
The Moores took everything. The Moores and their relatives took all of the Cape Fear River, all the way up as far as Black Rock. Because when people talk about the Cape Fear, you imagine it's just that stretch from Southport to Wilmington. Back in the day, it's the stretch from Southport to Fayetteville. That's the Cape Fear River. And so there were 100 plantations between Smithville, Southport, and Fayetteville, all doing naval stores. It was a huge industry.
So Lewis has had to do his research, which included the Moores and also the Howe family. Robert Howe, the famous general who served alongside George Washington in the Revolutionary War, was also a justice of the peace and represented Bladen County in the Colonial General Assembly before North Carolina became a state. Here's Lewis on Robert Howe.
General Howe, you know his whole background. He was aide-de-camp in Washington. He was in charge of the army in Savannah. They lost Savannah, so then he went back to being aide-de-camp after a period of hiding out for a while. But in any case, after the war, he lived around here. His family's place was Howe Point, which is now where Sunny Point is.
The Moore family married the Howes and also the Grange family, two more family names that are intertwined with the Black Rock story. Here's Jim on the Howe line.
Nathaniel came here and got the land grant and came here. He married Sarah Grange. His sister married Job Howe, Robert's father. Mm-hmm. They were all from Charleston. Mm-hmm. And Job came up here. Nathaniel deeded that land to Job in 1735. Okay. He got it in about 1728 or 9, deeded, so he wasn't here long.
Through owning the house and exploring its story, Lewis has met fellow travelers with their own vested interest in preserving its history.
Because I met Jim because of the house. I met Ernestine because of the house. And that's amazing, really. That's kind of why we preserve things, right? For these discussions, for these experiences, for the humans involved, for the people involved. Because otherwise, what is really the point?
And that's brought Ernestine and Jim together. They're standing in front of Black Rock, where tractor trailers go racing by.
Black Rock is his legacy as well as mine. You know, because this is Black Rock Plantation House, and Nathaniel Moore had the first one. This is a continuation of Jim's lineage, legacy. This is the only place that he can touch.
Of this, that's for sure.
For Jim, that means confronting some ugly legacies. He says he thinks that Nathaniel, his direct descendant, was less power-hungry than his brothers Roger and Maurice. But he still has to contemplate their roles as enslavers.
I've had this question in my mind forever. Can Nathaniel or anybody else who owns someone else be a good person? We understand we get trapped in our environments. That's what's going on back then.
And for Ernestine, that meant exploring the history and resilience of her ancestors before and after the Civil War. It is, on the one hand, part of the historical tragedy of chattel slavery, but it's also different from many narratives of the plantation era, in the ways that the Keaton's ancestors had a kind of leeway and autonomy that's rarely represented in stories from the antebellum era.
All right, we need to take a break, but we'll be back in a moment with more from Black Rock. I'm Rachel Keith.
And I'm Aaliyah McConnell. You're listening to The Newsroom. Stay with us.
Welcome back to The Newsroom. I'm Rachel Keith.
And I'm Aaliyah McConnell. Thanks for staying with us. Historical documents suggest that in the century before Black Rock was built, the Moors needed enslaved people to help clear the land they were settling. As Ernestine's sister Cecile notes, they also possibly helped remove some of the native peoples from around that area. The sad reality underlying the entire American story is that they were the first people to inhabit the area. It often goes unmentioned that they were mistreated, pushed off their ancestral lands, and even killed.
They came, automatically they had to wipe the Indians out. I'm sorry. But after that, then they bought the slaves in. So they bought skilled slaves from Barbados or whatever else.
Jim shares Cecile's assessment of what happened.
At some point, the people up here wanted their help in dealing with the Indians because they were having squabbles and everything. So they came up for that reason, and the Indians got pushed out like they did.
They destroyed them.
Yeah, yes, absolutely. And sold them as slaves. Mm-hmm. So they came up here, mainly Maurice, and did that. And then they went on up north of here for a while, and then wound up coming back here and settled in Bill Brunswick Town and what became Kendall and Orton and York and everything.
Cecile shares her sister's passion for the family's history. And together, the Keaton sisters have been a big part of Jim's quest to learn about Black Rock.
Well, the best thing that has come out of this for me is I feel like these two ladies are long-lost cousins.
Yes.
Our ancestors had common experiences. You know, they were in this together.
Yes.
And now we're here and we can talk about it and study it and learn from it and whatever. And I think we're all kind of in the same boat, wanting to really understand.
Cecile believes their earliest ancestors in the region came from Sierra Leone through the Caribbean, where they planted rice. Yeah.
So that means that it was a connection between the Moors and all of this in Barbados. So I think that's how a lot of the slaves got skilled on only in this area, like in Brunswick County, whatever. You find a lot of skilled people. They're not college people. They're not whatever. They are just skilled laborers. They're brick masons. They're carpenters.
But there was another extremely profitable industry known as naval stores. The pine trees that covered the area were turned into things like tar, pitch, and turpentine, used to waterproof and maintain the sailing ships coming into the port along the Cape Fear River. Lewis said he learned that at one point, Brunswick County's naval stores helped support the entire British Empire.
These things were used on ships, wooden sailing ships, which is why Britain liked Brunswick County from the beginning, because it had a giant maritime, it was a maritime empire. And Brunswick County supplied as much as 50% of these products for the entire world.
The industry also played a role in the particular and somewhat unique experience that the Keaton ancestors had. Here's Lewis.
The center of all of this is the naval stores industry. What these plantations were and how they functioned really. And the short version is, if you're harvesting products of pine trees, you have to have a lot of dirt and you have to have some people to do it. but you can't watch them. The people doing the work have an enormous amount of autonomy. They're responsible for as many as 1,000 trees. And each week, they have to check these 1,000 trees. And if you have, you know, 20 guys in the woods, they have to be in different sections doing their own thing.
Ann Lewis says in his research, there was this whole culture built around the naval stores and harvesting these pine trees.
A visitor's journal from the early 19th century, and they're coming through Brunswick County. And the journals, and the guy writing the journal, I assume it's a guy, the guy writing a journal says, passing through the woods, I hear yodeling all day. And it's all the African-Americans working, he didn't use the word African-Americans, the African-American men working in the pine industry are yodeling to each other in the woods. So that's part of the lost world, right? Hearing how these men communicated to themselves in the woods and let each one know where they were. But he said the song, the yodeling went on and on and on. And it was, as you went on this road through Brunswick County, you heard it everywhere.
As we mentioned before, Ernestine describes her ancestors as having an uncommon level of leeway and even certain freedoms that you don't often hear about in stories about enslaved people.
I think they started their own way of running their plantation, their slaves. I would say that they had autonomy, starting from Nathaniel Moore going down. They were all family. And as the area was divided up and given to other members of the same family, they adopted the same philosophy.
Black Rock had 6 documented slave quarters, though according to Lewis, some locals, like Ernestine, believe it to be more. They were all likely torn down by the end of the 1900s, and it's not exactly clear where they were located. Ernestine believes that they may have been built along Wayman Creek, a miles-long walk from the actual plantation, since work in the lumber and turpentine industry required quick access to a water source for the transport of goods. Again, despite the oppressive conditions of slavery, people found a way to have a little agency and even start a little community.
And they had to have their workers out by the creeks and the branches. So you had, along Wayman Creek, you had, you know, a slave, you know, house here. And then maybe it was a little room for a little garden or something. But it wasn't, everybody wasn't bunched together. So you're beginning to make a community. But when you talk about Sandyfield, this is it. It came from these slave houses that were there from the colonial days.
We wanted to get an expert's perspective, so we asked Dr. Joshua Strayhorn, a postdoctoral fellow at the Richard Civil War Era Center out of Pennsylvania State University. He's mainly a historian of 19th to 20th century African-American history. He grew up in New Bern and still goes back to visit family. Strayhorn said the Keaton's ancestral account is indeed plausible.
And so you have skilled artisans and also to the turpentine industry, a sort of workforce or labor type that requires you to be away from, you know, surveillance for extended periods of time. It seems to me that some people could use that opportunity to either escape or to live, you know, semi-autonomous lives.
Another way it differed was the fact that Ernestine's ancestors were allowed to get married.
It created a certain amount of stability for slaves, you know, as a family. To have my great grandmother, you know, to know that she got married in 1846. She was enslaved. She knew when she got married. When I looked at the registry of freed people's marriages, I saw 13 women declare their marriages in 1866 in New Hanover County, and that was part of Pender County then. But they were able to say they were married on such and such a date.
Strayhorn said that marriages, in the legal contractual sense, would have been very rare at that time.
Generally speaking, enslaved people weren't able to enter contracts, and marriages was one of those contracts that they were barred from.
But it's plausible that Keaton's ancestors held marriage ceremonies which were as well documented and meaningful as any other. And later, after the Civil War, records retroactively noted the dates of those marriages.
I had heard the grandchildren of former slaves say the day after they was going around, and they didn't have to go far because, like I said, this kinship network, if you were a man and you were in Black Rock or Grange Farm or Lloyd Plantation, you knew where your wife was. And you go to her and you stay with her because she had the house.
Ernestine says during the antebellum period, the culture was different in Columbus County compared to Wilmington proper.
We got the other people. We got the ones that wanted to be laid back. You know, they came up this way. They came up the northwest branch up here and decided that we don't want all the hustle and bustle from Wilmington and whatever. We're going to create our own place here, and we're going to make our own rules. And if we want to go down to Brunswick County, we'll go. But otherwise, we can do anything we want here. And I just have that feeling that it's like that, you know, all over as far as rural areas are concerned.
Strayhorn said the Keatons likely have a special story. Ernestine's claim was that enslaved people found a degree of freedom and autonomy thanks to their skills and favorable economic conditions of, for example, the naval store industry. It's a story of resilience and survival, but it doesn't negate the horrors of the era. Strayhorn said slavery was still slavery.
Because it could very much be that, and that could very much be their ancestors' remembrances. But people were still chattel, they could still be mortgaged, all those sorts of things too. So I think you can make space for, you know, because they do have a very unique story, because I've never actually heard of people in that way, both inherit the land, but also maintain it for that long of a period of time.
And there is a story that Lewis has researched, that an enslaved man named Sam basically helped run the plantation after the death of D.D. Allen, whose family name is often attached to Black Rock. When Allen passed away, his widow Callista and Sam continued to run things. Here's Lewis.
Sam was in charge of probably a workshop at Black Rock, which made the barrels, which were then taken down to the dock, which used to be on the Cape Fear. The property used to go all the way to the Cape Fear, and then a steamboat, because there used to be regular steamboats up and down between Wilmington and Fayetteville. They put out a flag, and the steamboat would pull over and pick up the barrels of rosin and take them down to Wilmington.
Despite the dehumanizing conditions of the time, Sam found a way to have some real agency. Strayhorn says he wants the public to know about an online history project that talks about this issue. It's called Just Beyond the River, a Black Public Humanities Initiative, and it was funded by the African American Heritage Foundation of Southeastern NC and American Council of Learned Societies. These scholars write about the naval stores around Brunswick County and capture this rub, whether what they had equated to real autonomy and power. The historical scholars write, quote, "There is some debate concerning the major slave economies of the region, with different scholars arguing for the importance of rice cultivation or naval stores. This has impacted the way scholars have discussed the autonomy or violence of slave life. Some scholars suggest that laboring in the forest for naval store production allowed slaves autonomy and time away from their masters, but it also situated them alongside potentially more violent white overseers."
The scholars continue. Lastly, there has been discussion of the relative autonomy of slave life in Wilmington, where some slaves are known to have had their own residences and participated in the market trade. Despite this, Wilmington was a space of public punishment and displays of violence. White authorities also tried to curtail the practices of slaves and free people of color in Wilmington through regulations designed to prevent slaves from holding accommodation, trading items such as gunpowder, making noise, or simply being idle. Altogether, then, this collection is a window into the evolving economies, cultures, and social lives of those living in the slaveholding region of southeastern North Carolina during the 18th and 19th centuries. There's another exceptional part of the Keaton family history that Ernestine points to. Historical research that shows while many of her ancestors were enslaved people, others were part of the community of free Black people around East Arcadia in Bladen County, close to Black Rock.
Before, like maybe from 1790 on, people were attracted to Bladen County, you know, free people coming, and we never had that in Sandyfield. For some reason, it seemed to stop right there and didn't go any further. Bladen County had loads of, you know, free people, like 430-something people.
In Ernestine's oral history, those living around Black Rock were immediately freed after Wilmington was captured by the Union Army.
I remember talking to a granddaughter of a former slave from the plantation there. And she said that the day that Wilmington fell and they were free, he asked them to stay on. And they did.
And Black Rock has a place in marking the end of the Civil War. Union General William Sherman's lieutenants might have stayed there when they were on his infamous March to the Sea, Lewis says.
It's a huge crowd of people walked from Fayetteville to Wilmington. And there weren't a lot of houses on the road back in the day. So they probably spent the night, Captain Winslow probably commandeered the house to spend the night with this rabble of people.
Strayhorn notes that Wilmington was the last bastion of the Confederacy.
Wilmington wouldn't be taken until the winter of 1864 into 1865. So in that case, free people use that opportunity to claim freedoms, engage in politics in ways that many of them hadn't before, and also claim land. Sherman's March to the Sea is one of the famous examples of liberation in this area, and his Special Field Order 15 actually gave enslaved people the land of abandoned lands that they encountered as they were moving throughout the South. This would later be overturned by Andrew Johnson, but this moment that you have emancipation is really a moment where people are imagining what freedom could look like for them.
Ernestine's family acquired land about 5 years after the Civil War. And in 2026, many of the Keatons, as we will learn later in the story, have stayed in the town of Sandyfield near where Black Rock still stands. Strayhorn says that this was plausible, but notes that for formerly enslaved people across eastern North Carolina, acquiring land wasn't the easiest thing to do.
And so for families, it was an opportunity to claim land, to build on either legacies developed before the war or to start anew, whether it's finding family members or re-engage with the old plantation masters on different terms. Sometimes this was not happy, or obviously this was not this was not always a harmonious reunion, because many owners would be taken aback by free people's articulations of this newfound freedom that they had, and often would be hostile to them, and they would need either the Freedmen's Bureau or the army that was there to adjudicate some of the things that were going on, grievances that they had with their former masters after the war was over.
The Freedmen's Bureau was a federal agency established in 1865 that helped formerly enslaved people after the Civil War. Its work in overseeing confiscated or abandoned lands was more or less over by 1868 under then President Andrew Johnson. Ernestine and Cecile are proud that they can trace their ancestry through before the Civil War and that most of their family still remain. Strayhorn said the fact that their ancestors owned the land fairly quickly after the Civil War could be one of the reasons for them to stay.
So what I was finding is that in certain situations where people were able to acquire land, they were much less likely to leave the state versus when people were sort of landless in that way.
All right, we need to take one more quick break, but we'll be back in a moment with more from Black Rock. I'm Rachel Keith.
And I'm Aaliyah McConnell. You're listening to The Newsroom. Stay with us.
Welcome. Welcome back to the newsroom. I'm Rachel Keith.
And I'm Aaliyah McConnell. Thanks for staying with us.
After the Allens, Black Rock was owned by the Loves, thus the Allen Love House, as it is sometimes called. The Love family married into the Allen family, and the house was passed down to John Brown and Clara Allen Love, and then Laura Love, who was born in 1876 and lived into her 80s. Julia Peterson is Laura Love's second cousin, and like many families who came to settle in this area around Black Rock, they started in Charleston and Wilmington, and then moved out to Columbus and Bladen counties.
I can verifiably trace it to 1776 in the New Hanover County area. We've heard that two Love brothers came from London in 1750 via Charleston to Wilmington. Oral history from my dad, who was born in 1919, he says that Dr. William J. Love, who was a physician during the Civil War in Wilmington, suggested that it would be a good idea for people to move farther out from the coast because of the threat of yellow fever. And obviously, our little part did.
Julia still has land close to where Laura lived. She says she's not sure why Black Rock didn't stay in the family after Laura Love died in 1959.
It's a little bit of a mystery to me of why none of the Loves either inherited or purchased her property.
Julia has Laura's diaries, and she's been reading them, and she discovered Laura was working locally for the American Red Cross Nurse Corps. And Laura mainly lived alone, and she was a poet, a lyricist, and an educator. And from Everett Lewis's research, Laura Love was also a suffragette.
So it was decided to leave the property to the daughter, whose name, I think it was Caroline Love. And Caroline passed it through her family. And when Miss Laura took over, it seemed that nobody else wanted to take it on. Living in Philadelphia at the time because she was a suffragettist. And she was also a musician.
According to Lewis, Laura Love was a tutor to some of the Black families who lived around Black Rock, and she continued her songwriting at the house and would host her colleagues from up north.
1 week a year, her publishers would come and stay at Black Rock, and she would, I guess, play all the music for them and hang out and eat who knows what. There are a lot of, whenever I'm digging for planting, there's always oyster shells I dig up.
Julia is still on the hunt for finding out things about Laura Love and hopes to continue, like Jim Moore and Ernestine Keaton, to be her family's researcher.
It's just a way for me to figure out what I missed in the past and, you know, to pass things on, you know, oral storytelling, because that never happens anymore. So I've been chosen to be that person.
After Laura Love, the property moved to a family called the Owens, and then Everett Lewis bought it, which brings us to today.
For Ernestine Keaton's family, they're not just surviving, but thriving, and asserting power through local governance of the town of Sandyfield, something that was unimaginable in the antebellum era. Gary Keaton is her cousin and has been the mayor of Sandyfield for over 15 years. Her brother, Randolph, is a town council member. After high school, Gary Keaton went into the Air Force and served for 20 years, then retired and moved back home. His dad worked at International Paper.
I always had the desire to come back home. My parents were here.
Gary says the townspeople are mostly family.
I would say that 75% of the residents of Sandyfield literally know one another. And probably about that same percentage are connected either biologically connected or either they're married to someone.
A little over three decades ago, the town incorporated, giving residents some say in the area's development and future.
You know, it was really that the citizens wanted to have some control as to what came in, what kind of industry, what the growth looked like, and all of the developing things that happen in a small town when you're not incorporated, you know, incorporated.
Prior to incorporation, Gary says things were decided for them, and now saying no to certain development in the town is within their power. Recently, officials from Bladen County requested that their newly built campground's drainage system would extend into Sandyfield.
But they wanted to put some of the drain fields in Columbus County, which was in the town of Sandyfield. So We had a public hearing. We listened to what our residents wanted, and the residents said, no, we don't want this. So the town board decided that, you know what, we don't want this in our town.
Gary understood that the development went through the proper protocols, but it still wasn't something the residents wanted.
It's a closed system. It's safe. It has to be. It's regulated by the state. So all of those things are okay. All of those things are fine. But it's still the perception that, you know what, this is not what I want next to my house. This is not what I want in my community.
Still, there are some things that remained out of their control. When Sandy Field was incorporated, a hog farm was entirely cut out of the town's boundaries.
When the map was drawn for Sandy Field, that part, and it would have made sense, it honestly would have made sense for that area had the hog farm not been there. Or I think it probably, that part where the hog farm is, would have been included in Sandy Field. But it was actually, that parcel of land was actually cut out. So literally it's right next door. It butts up to Sandy Field, but they drew the property, they drew the town line and excluded the hog farm.
Ernestine talks about the hog farm being near Black Rock. It abuts the property, and we smelled it when we visited there in early January.
I hate the idea of somebody coming into your space and they don't live in it, and they are spraying a hog poop, you know, whenever they get ready and you got to come out. But I guess maybe the wind takes it this way.
And while these are the realities of the town, Gary says there isn't too much of a hustle and bustle around Sandy Field. Their next exciting project is a walking path.
Some of the things that we are actually working on, we just received a grant for a walking trail that's going to be around the perimeter of this parcel of land here. And so that's going to allow our seniors and younger people to an opportunity to exercise in a safe place.
Gary says he wants more economic opportunity in the town. He says most have to travel to work in Whiteville or Wilmington or Elizabethtown.
I wish there was more diversity. I wish there were more opportunities, but the area is still growing. International Paper just did some recent hiring, from what I can understand.
And for him and his family members, Ernestine and Cecile, it's always about helping and empowering the people who live in your community. They've been doing it for a long time.
We try to look out for each other. You know, we try to do neighborly things, you know, whether it's, you know, growing a garden and, you know, giving some of your fresh vegetables to a neighbor or giving them a ride to a doctor's appointment.
And Gary says he's a product of all the people who have come before him.
I hear people say a lot of times now that, you know, when the Lord wants to bless you, he doesn't send you things, he sends you people. And those people are what's been the biggest blessing in my life, you know. So now that I'm back and I'm connected to those people, now I'm able to bless them just like they blessed me and pass on the things that I was able to reap and benefit from the lessons they taught me. Now I'm able to pass those things on to the people that come behind me.
Despite their differences and different history, Black Rock has bonded Jim Moore, Everett Lewis, Ernestine and Gary Keaton, Cecile Bryant, and Julia Peterson. They are all bound to the land surrounding Black Rock. They are all sharing in its memories, its history, and its people. We rode with Jim and Ernestine to Wayman Creek, which used to be on the Black Rock property. The entrance was closed off, but we stood there for a while at the opening of a quiet wooded pathway and took in the moment and reveled in the possibility that we were standing on the same ground as the Keaton family's enslaved ancestors. But one place we knew that to be true was at Black Rock Plantation, the place that ties these families together across generations. In front of the Black Rock house, Ernestine talked about the first time she met Everett.
We came to visit him one day, the new owner, and I told Everett, I said, Everett, you know, we came today, we thought you were gonna be sitting on the porch with your black swallowtail coat and drinking mint juleps. Oh, he thought that was so funny.
When we put those comments to Lewis, he thought it was hilarious that she had a vision of Gone with the Wind.
I mean, oh my God, it was so much more interesting than Gone with the Wind, by the way, because Gone with the Wind is entirely a product of Hollywood. It's not about fancy clothes. Believe me, it's not about fancy clothes. And mint juleps?
You can see why she expected a character right out of the mid-19th century. Greek-style columns line the front porch of the Black Rock House, with twin chimneys flanking the broad building. Modest compared to today's McMansions, it was quite striking in its day, though there is a dark side to that grandeur. For many, the lone white house, sitting in contrast with the vast field of green, symbolizes an ugly period in our country's history.
And Lewis has contemplated this too.
Can you change the past? No. Can the past change you? Maybe. If you're open to understanding the past and your relationship to it. That's the essential difference. And also the essential level of understanding you have to approach going into the past. That's the beauty of the past. It's not something to cover up. It's something to negotiate. And so that's, and Ernestine does it in her way. I do it in my way. And we have to. We have no choice. As the history of that house has unfolded, it's loaded. It's a very loaded, complex history. And who knew? I came into it because I like the architecture, and I still do, but it's become a much more interesting place. You know, it just keeps unpacking. It's like I learn more stuff all the time, and I don't even mean to. It just happens.
But for Keaton, this place represents one of the most American stories ever told.
I saw how the slave owner and the slave, their descendants, were right in the same place doing things that elevated them and their family.
Standing near the banks of Wayman Creek, Ernestine holds up a copy of that document she got from her friend Ulysses Willis, a tax assessment from over 150 years ago that inspired her to search for her own history. After years of wondering why she was so attached to Black Rock, Ernestine now feels like she finally has the answer to that question, having found her family in the pages of history.
Am I in the right place? Were y'all here? You know, this is what I would want to know. Or not to doubt myself, but to tell him that I felt their presence from the time I was at the Black Rock Plantation House. I didn't know at the time, but for some reason I was drawn to it. And then I had the tax assessment schedule. And you know, Granddaddy, I saw you on there. And I saw your mama, Caroline, on there, and I knew that I had found you.
This year marks the 250th anniversary of America's founding. Black Rock plays a part in that history, bringing together the story of our nation, one that included colonialism and slavery, but also brought out the hope of the American dream and the courage to plant roots and to keep them growing. Thank you to Ernestine Keaton, Gary Keaton, Cecile Bryant, Jim Moore, Julia Peterson, Ulysses Willis, Everett Lewis, and Dr. Joshua Strayhorn. On another note, photojournalist Madeline Gray came with us to Black Rock to capture our visit. You can find those at whqr.org. And thank you to our editor, Ben Schockman, for helping us weave together this narrative. For WHQR's newsroom, I'm Rachel Keith.
And I'm Aaliyah McConnell. Thank you for listening.